was all very proper and respectful. First, these men went to Ali, one after the other, and then Ali came to me to present their case. Each time he went into detail about the man, what a hard worker he was and a decent provider, reliable, Osman Mahmoud, of course, how I could move into a house nearby and this man would take care of me. It was all about money and security. There was no idea of love as described in the novels I had read. Even Bollywood movies contained more romance than this. One of these suitors was very persistent. He was in his late 20s, a staunch Muslim, but thick, I thought, as well as ugly, and completely unschooled. He pleaded. He told me how motivated he was to protect me. That was his highest card. If I said yes, he told me, he would travel to Somalia to look for my father, or at least my brother, and obtain their approval, which is obviously the only permission that actually counted. There was no discussion of attraction or compatibility. Privately, I thought it was surreal. This wasn't my idea of wooing. I wanted excitement, someone dashing and gorgeous, deeply learned, with dark eyes and a sense of humor. I wanted to be swept off my feet. I dreaded becoming a married woman. I didn't want to settle down to Jawahir's life. I didn't want to grow fat and old like my schoolmate, Zainab. I didn't want to turn into my mother and have the kind of sex that Sahra and Jawahir did. I said no each time, very politely. I told Ali that I wanted to finish school before I could even consider such a thing. Thankfully, Ma backed me up. She told Ali that I couldn't be betrothed in the absence of my father and brother. It wouldn't be right. It wouldn't be following the rules. It would look furtive, she told him. Privately, I'm sure she considered such marriages beneath her. When Halwa's parents moved to a new house they had constructed in one of the expensive estates that were springing up around the city, they offered to rent my mother an apartment in the small building they had just left on Park Road. Just before we moved in, Hawea returned from Mogadishu with a suitcase full of short skirts and a new glint in her eye. When she saw her, Ma covered her eyes and exclaimed, "Allah, what now?" My mother had hoped that Somalia would tame Hawea, but she returned even more willful than when she had left, with a completely adult determination about her. Hawea had seen a different side to Somalia than my mother had expected. Somali women do seek to be bari, the ideal behavior for a woman to serve well. Almost all of them are genitally excised, which the Arabs mostly don't. Which, by the way, is no longer true. But traditionally, Somali women work, which makes them unlike Arab women, and perhaps freer. Islam was never as forceful in Somalia as it has always been in Saudi Arabia, the country of its origin, and some Somali women of my father's generation were very modern in their outlook. Our cousin, Ibadadadi Magan, and even to some extent our stepmother, Marian Farah, were examples to Hawea. They were very different from my mother, who had become frozen in passive, bitter resentment since the day my father left. Hawea came home full of plans to go out and work. She said she had decided to come back to Kenya because the education was better. Ibadadadi had convinced her that she needed qualifications. Hawea didn't want to return to high school and study for her O-level exams. She thought she was much too old for that. She would go to secretarial school since she didn't need O-levels to get in. A few months after Hawea came back, I took my O-level exams and barely passed. There was no way I could go on to do A-levels with such grades, and I was too proud to even think of going back a year and trying again. Hawea and I decided that we would go to secretarial school together. We knew it wouldn't be easy to persuade Ma, who wanted to go and stay in an Islamic boarding house for girls down the road, to learn to cook and clean and read the Quran. I told her I was already cooking and cleaning and reading the Quran, and that secretarial school would be just like secondary school, really. Hawea and I carefully avoided stating the obvious, which was that secretarial school would make us qualified to work in offices, that we planned, in fact, to earn our own living. We told Ma that Ibadah would pay Hawea's fees, the United Nations Refugee Agency would pay part of mine because I was a refugee and had completed high school, and this was vocational training. Finally, grudgingly, Ma agreed to pay the rest. Early in 1988, Ma had sent Ma a letter from Somalia. He wrote that he had met Abdullahi Abdi Aynab, the eldest son of the prison director who had been executed for helping my father escape from jail. Abdullahi lived in Adhan, Ma had said. He had his own business, was only 24 years old, worked hard and was devout, and Abdullahi Abdi Aynab respectfully requested my hand in marriage. My mother sat me down. This was a beautiful match, she told me. There was a symmetry to it. My father would certainly approve. She did her best to persuade me to say yes to Mahat's plan. But the whole idea chilled me. I honored this man's father, of course. He was a saint to us. Still, could Mahat really expect me to say yes to marry someone I hadn't even met and live in a country I had never been? I wrote the most perfect letter back to Mahat. I told him, "My dearest brother, I'm only 18, and marriage remains far from my mind. I must experience a period of adulthood before I jump from being a child to my husband's house." It was polite and respectful, but clear. Then Mahat wrote to me directly to tell me to think about it, and a few days later, a letter arrived from Abdullahi Abdi Aynab himself. It was a beautiful letter in elegant Somali. He was from a very cultivated family, introducing himself, talking about his views of life, and including two photographs of him in Adhan. It was a little like a pen pal letter, minus the smiley faces. I still didn't feel drawn to the idea of marrying this man, but in terms of wedding proposals to a complete stranger, he did his best, I thought. My mother was swept off her feet by the photographs of Adhan, the city where her adult life had begun. She told me this marriage was my destiny. I wasn't ready to make this decision and felt trapped just thinking about it. Still, my mother and my brother more or less settled down between themselves that when it came time for me to marry, it would be to this man. I didn't think it was much of a threat. Abdullahi Abdi Aynab was in Adhan. Mahat was in Somalia. It wasn't as if there were any kind of immediate plan. I wrote back to him saying that I wasn't rejecting him as a person, that I couldn't, since I had never met him. But marriage was simply not on my horizon right now. And this was fine. Nothing was signed. Nobody forced me. I had begun to skip the Islamic debates on Thursday nights. As the months went on, I found them more predictable and less inspiring. I kept seeing inconsistencies in the arguments, and my questions were getting no real answers. There was nothing new. The speakers were making us aware of the old fundamentals of Islam and the need to adhere to and practice that faith much more actively. But there was no progress in the lessons, no change, and any interpretation seemed to be for the sake of convenience rather than logic. It was as if my head had somehow divided in two. When in Sister Aziza's world, I was devout, meek, and respectful of the many, many barriers that restricted me to a very narrow role. The rest of the time, I read novels and lived in the world of my imagination filled with daring. As a reader, I could put on someone else's shoes and live through his adventures, borrow his individuality, make choices that I didn't have at home. The moral dilemmas I found in books were so interesting they kept me awake. The answers to them were unexpected and difficult, but they had an internal logic you could understand. Reading Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I understood that the two characters were just one person, that both evil and good live in each of us at one time. This was more exciting than rereading the hadith. I began sneaking out from time to time to go to the cinema with Hawea or some of the other Somali girls. It didn't feel like sinning. It felt like friendship. When I prayed these days, I skipped a lot of the prayers. It was rare now for me to pray five times every day. In February 1989, the BBC ran the news that the Ayatollah Khomeini had issued an order to kill a man called Salman Rushdie, who had written a book about the wives of the Prophet Muhammad titled The Satanic Verses. There had been riots across the Muslim world about this evil book. The Ayatollah, Said Rushdie, who was born Muslim, was guilty of blasphemy and the crime of apostasy, seeking to renounce the faith, which is punishable by execution. He sentenced him to death and set a price on Rushdie's head. One evening, a few weeks later, Sister Aziza and her husband stopped by our flat to ask me to take a walk with them over to the Muslim community center beside the school where our debates took place. A small crowd had gathered in the parking lot. Some young men drove up in a car and made a show of burning small flags, the Israeli flag, the American flag. Then they tied Rushdie's book onto a stick and doused it with kerosene and held a cigarette lighter to it, cheering as it smoldered pitifully in the drizzle. Sister Aziza was cheering and chanting beside me. I felt estranged, somehow very uncomfortable. I wondered if it wasn't a little silly to have bought even one copy of this book to burn it. After all, the money would still go to its author. It didn't even occur to me to question that Salman Rushdie should be killed. If Rushdie had insulted the Prophet, then he deserved to die. Evidently, Rushdie had written something so horrible that I didn't even know what it was. But burning a book seemed like something that the apartheid government in South Africa would do. I couldn't articulate why I was uneasy, but I left early. I think that may have been the last time I went to the debate center. Hawa and I started classes at a secretarial college downtown. It was rubbish. 50 or 60 girls were crammed into a big room above a shop, with not even enough typewriters to go around. Lesson one was left hand, first finger, type, FFF. Right hand, first finger, type, JJJ. We learned nothing, so at the end of the day, we demanded that our fees be refunded. It was an extraordinary feeling to stand alongside Hawa and demand something from a total stranger. Together, I found we could both be strong. We looked around for a better education. We asked girls we knew who worked where the best secretaries came from. They recommended Valley Secretarial College, which had 15 students per class and taught shorthand and had real computers. It was in Kilimani, 2 bus rides across the sprawl of outer Nairobi, and it was expensive, but we registered. Secretarial school wasn't intellectually stimulating, but it meant we were out in the world. For the first time, I really saw the streets of Nairobi as we rattled back and forth in the matatu bus every day. One time, as I was walking to the matatu, I heard a shriek of, "Thief!" A crowd of people caught a man who was running down the road, a Kenyan boy about my age, wearing just a pair of shorts. As I walked by, I saw him, cringing on the ground in the middle of a circle of people who were throwing big stones at him. The crowd got bigger and more determined, some of them dressed in tatters and others wearing suits. Young girls were cheering as if the Kenyan team had won the World Cup. There were stones, shrieks, kicks, more stones. People were shouting, "Mwizi! Mwizi! Thief! Thief!" The kid was severely wounded. Blood was streaming from his head. Every blow made him bleed more. His eyes were so swollen you couldn't see them anymore. Then someone kicked him hard in the mouth, and he just lay there on the ground, twitching. I thought I would throw up. I slipped back. I couldn't watch anymore. This was the most disgusting sight I had ever seen. I felt guilty just having watched, as though I had participated. The boy probably died. As long as we had lived in Nairobi, we had heard about lynchings, thieves killed on the streets by vengeful mobs. But this was the first time I had ever seen one. The atmosphere at Secretarial College was also far more lurid than at Muslim girls. In school, some of the Kenyan girls had giggled about sex. To them, it was natural to go out and attract boys. Still, almost all of them were practicing Christians and devoted to the ideals of Christian marriage. But at Valley Secretarial School, our classmates were openly unchaste. They freely admitted to having sex with men. They lived the lives my mother banned us from living, which made them both deeply shocking to me and also fascinating. Lucy, for example, was chatty and friendly and loved to talk. She wore clothes so tight you could see every roll in her thighs. She said, "A man likes something to hold on to." Lucy went to discos every weekend to drink beer and meet men, and when she was fed up with one man after a few weeks, she found another. She just laughed when we commented and told us, with friendly scorn, "You can't eat the same meal every day." Lucy talked about sex all the time. To her, a virgin was either too ugly and stuck up for boys to want her, or a religious fanatic. Virginity was ridiculous. "Why would I promise myself to one man when I can get them all?" she asked me once. "What is this cage you are in, girl?" Lucy considered religion in general boring, and Islam in particular creepy, and she made no secret of it. She didn't aspire to marriage, she aspired to fun. And to Lucy, sex was fun. Sometimes men gave you money, which was good, and sometimes they could dance well, which was terrific. But that wasn't the point. Lucy liked having sex, and when she stopped liking it with one man, she just found another man to be with. After we had known her for a few months, Lucy announced that she was pregnant. She said she had done it on purpose, because this man was just too good-looking, and she wanted a pretty baby. Her life seemed almost otherworldly to me. At the time, I was still putting on my robe every morning to take the matatu home. We asked Lucy if her parents would not punish her severely for this, but she laughed that no, her parents would take care of the baby. They would even be pleased with her if it was particularly cute. I still missed my father. I was staggered by Lucy's irresponsibility about her baby, and I confess I lectured her. We ended up falling out. But whether it was Lucy's influence or not, I did begin to relax a bit about my huge black robe. It was dawning on me that I wouldn't be able to keep wearing it for long if I was planning to work in an office in Nairobi. I almost certainly wouldn't be allowed to wear my hijab at work. The robe had begun to seem cumbersome too, and also rather stupid. What counted surely was my intention to behave modestly. I began wearing a long tailored coat like Halwa did. I also began avoiding Sister Aziza. I knew she wouldn't approve. We received our grades in September 1989. Lucy, by now visibly pregnant, failed. Hawea and I both graduated with first-class certificates as Valley College Secretaries. We came home elated and told Ma she needn't worry any more about all the rent we owed. Now that we could work, we would be able to support her. Ma got up from the stool she used to sit on by the brazier with a face like thunder. We would not work. She was adamant. To our mother, for a young, unmarried girl to work in an office was second cousin to prostitution. Grandma was behind her all the way. "Money earned by a woman has never made anyone rich," she said, quoting yet another from her endless supply of anachronistic proverbs. I turned to her way grimly and said in English, "Then we'll move out." I knew now that there were such things as hostels. We could rent a room somewhere decent and live our own lives. Perhaps Ma understood more English than I thought. When we stomped into our room, she slipped out and bought a huge stock of food and 3 padlocks. When Hawea and I headed out that evening for a walk, we found all the doors barred. "You're not going anywhere," Ma said. "You have food. Cook it if you're hungry." Hawea went insane. She pulled off her headscarf and coat and yelled, "It's my ambition in life to become a prostitute. I know everything about how to get pregnant. Look at my breasts and buttocks. I will call a man to the window and tell him to give me his sperm, and I will get pregnant." Her screaming went on for hours. I could see that in a way Ma was enjoying Hawea's sharp, biting language, but that didn't make her any less angry. Days of rage and tedium went by behind bars. I found an outrage inside myself I hadn't known I possessed. We passed notes through the window to people who lived in our building and asked them to take them to Halwa and Sahara. Halwa's mother came over to try to persuade Ma that she couldn't keep us locked up until we died there. It simply wasn't a solution. We were clever girls and had no father, and after all, our mother didn't have any other means of support. She told Ma we could find a decent Muslim company to work for, one that would at least permit us to wear a headscarf. Ma went to the Osman Mahmoud again, to Farah Gure and the other men. Farah Gure agreed that Ma had a perfect right to prevent us from working if that was best for us in her judgment. But we could not be married because our father was not available to approve the match. And padlocking us into the house was simply not a long-term solution. Farah Gure said the only thing to do was to send us back to Somalia, a good Muslim country. We could perhaps work there. In any case, it was obvious we could benefit from living among Somalis. Ma had no choice but to agree. When we heard we could be going to Somalia, I was thrilled. Hawea told me, "Ayan, put both your legs back on the ground. You won't like it." She knew what I was expecting. I was expecting to be recognized and loved. I thought Somalia would be full of only decent people, all behaving toward one another as they should. Somehow the Somalis in Somalia would be different from all the Somalis I knew in Kenya. Jawahir had told me there was no crime or violence there. The weather would be warm all the time, not cold and misty as it often was in Nairobi. When I was growing up, I was always told that every little thing that went wrong in my mother's life was the fault of the Kenyans. Somalia meant trust and justice and fairness. In Somalia, everything would fall into place and make sense. I had also heard the news that the SSDF forces had advanced across the north of the country all the way to Bari. My father had already visited Somalia once, but he had refused to renounce the struggle and return to the wide smile of Siad Barre, as some of the other exiles had. Siad Barre's rule really did seem to be crumbling. One day soon, peace would come, and all Somali exiles would be able to go home. When we left in March 1990, I was 20 years old. I wasn't frightened of going to Mogadishu. I was glad to be leaving my mother in Nairobi and to be heading back to my true home and my roots. Chapter 7. Disillusion and Deceit. As soon as we came out of the plane in Mogadishu, the heat hit us. I loved it. I was so excited that Farah Gure's assistant who was traveling with us burst out laughing at me. But I was taken aback by the chaos. The airstrip was a path swept in the sand. Passengers scrabbled and tugged at a huge heap of battered suitcases that were dumped unceremoniously under the plane. Outside the airport, a swarm of men descended on us, urging us to ride with them into town. There was no order, no systems in place at all. It didn't matter. This was just the airport. I was prepared to forgive almost anything from the place where I would at last be at home. Mogadishu was beautiful at dusk. In those days, the city was not the scabbed, burned-out ruin that it is today, devastated by the violence of the clans. It was gentle and pleasant. As we rode to Marian Farah's house in a taxi, the streets looked deeply familiar. Downtown, the Italian buildings were stately, and the streets were fine white sand. All the people looked like me. They walked high and tall, the women striding down the street in long patterned deras. I fancied that I was truly coming home. We went to Marian Farah, my father's first wife, who lived in a big white villa in the Casa Popolare neighborhood, right near Tribunca Square. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it wasn't this. A prosperous, self-confident stepmother with a government job. I met my two stepsisters, who were as different as two girls could be. Arro, who was 25, and who I had actually met briefly in 1984, when her mother brought her to Nairobi for medical treatment, looked like our father, like me, with a round forehead and high cheekbones. She was delicate and small, in a pale green and mauve gauze dira, so transparent you could see her lace bra strap. with a pale green underskirt and mauve high heels. Aro was a medical student. Her younger sister, Ichabo, had just left school. She was dumpier and dressed in a thick, dark brown Islamic robe. Mahat was living in Mogadishu and he came to welcome us that evening. I hardly recognized my own brother. Mahat had never been fat, but in Kenya, there was always something soft about him. Now he had grown taller and more muscled, and the sun had burned his skin dark. He had spent 2 years in Mogadishu studying at an international college, but he had also been to Bari, and he had seen our father. Our father was in Somalia. He was just a few miles away, and Mahat had stayed with him. My heart leapt. Abe was in a place called Eil on the coast, quite near Bari. He had entered the country with the SSDF forces, which had gained control of most of the old Aysem Hamoud territory. There had been a lot of fighting, and our father was establishing a new administration on what was now free Somali soil. The situation in Eil was stable, but the road there from Mogadishu was extremely dangerous, so Mahat couldn't take us there yet. We would have to wait until an air connection could be opened. Bandits were roaming unchecked across the disputed territory. The army checkpoints alone were dangerous to pass. In the rainy season, a four-wheel drive vehicle could be stuck for days in the mud. People were robbed and raped on the road. Mahat couldn't risk delivering dead bodies to our father. But Abe was well. We would have to be patient. That first evening, we went to one of the neighborhoods near the ocean where the cool breeze filters in from the sea in the evenings. I filled my lungs with the smells, garlic, frankincense, and the salt sea. We bought lamb wrapped in hot pita bread, walked through the streets I remembered playing on sand just like this as a little girl, and I took off my shoes and walked barefoot. It was such a pleasure to feel the fine, dry, white grains of sand on my feet. In Nairobi, it was dusty, and when it rained, which was often, the ground was mud, so you never felt clean. And in Nairobi, everyone went to bed early. In Mogadishu, everyone came alive at night. All the shops were open, and the only pools of light in the darkness came from the shopkeepers' bare light bulbs. There were no street lamps in this neighborhood. Groups of people strolled around, young families with children. As we walked past the tailor's stalls, however, the electricity failed, so that the shops went dark and the whole street was suddenly plunged into complete darkness. Gradually, candles were lit and lanterns and a generator coughed to life. Somalia was clearly a lot poorer than Kenya. This hadn't occurred to me before. Mahat told us we would have to stay at Marian's house. Leaving her would make our family look bad. People would say there was jealousy in Hesimagan's family. He didn't issue an order, but he had a much more authoritative air about him now. It was a request, but it was also more than that. Hawea couldn't stand living in Marian's house, even though she liked and respected Marian. She may have hated Ma sometimes, but she felt a fierce loyalty to her, and liking Marian made her feel guilty. After a short while, Hawea moved out. But Mahat asked me to stay for the good of the family. It was an awkward situation. I always felt tension when Marian Farah was around. It wasn't her fault. She was gracious, perfectly observant of all the proper behavior. But I always felt there was a cross-current of something we were not supposed to feel, let alone voice. The house had an uncomfortable amount of static in the air anyway. Our older sister Aro could be spiteful, and she squabbled constantly with Ichabo. Ichabo wore a headscarf, even inside the house, and dressed in drab greys and browns. Outside the house, she wore the full jilbab, which covered the eyes with a separate thin black cloth. She eyed my hijab with approval, but there was something insufferably cloying about her. Both sisters clearly had mixed feelings about her wear. They seemed to envy her defiance, but didn't seem to like her. Aro and Ichabo treated us both as if we were in some way retarded. They sneered at our weirdness. We were tarnished by having grown up far away. Yet Arro in particular coveted every Western item that we owned. Neither of our new sisters read for pleasure. It was quite difficult to find books in Somalia, and no one seemed to read novels, which were common in Nairobi. Instead, they watched endless Indian movies and Arab soaps on television, which we found mystifying because the stories were fatuous, and Arro and Ichabo spoke even less Arabic and Hindi than we did. Arro was out of the house a lot, at the university. Ichabo, however, was still in high school. She was a completely devout believer in the Muslim Brotherhood. Marian thought Ichabo's devotions were probably just a phase, but she allowed her to study with a ma'alim who came every week to instruct Ichabo in the Qur'an. Ichabo invited me to join her Qur'an study a few times, but never again after I told her that I thought her ma'alim wasn't really teaching her anything, just reading the Qur'an in Arabic while she nodded. Ichabo was indignant. Who did I think I was? I who spoke English, the language of the infidels. How could I dare say this man who had studied in Medina was wrong? When Mahat visited, it was a relief to get out of the house. He often came over, usually with his friend Abshir, the younger son of the prison director who was executed for helping my father, and the brother of Abdullahi Abdi Aynab, the young man who had asked me to marry him. It felt natural for all of us to go out together with Hawea and Ichabo in a pack. We went to see other family members. It felt good to belong. This is what the bloodline was, this self-evident feeling of not having to justify your existence or explain anything. We joked around, we had fun. Mahat was always gallant and pleasant, even to Ichabo. His friend Abshir was dark-skinned and handsome, very polite and civilized, and bright. He was an imam in the Muslim Brotherhood movement, which was rapidly capturing the imagination of young people in the city. Abshir was intensely devout. He had put his mind to learning how to be a good Muslim, an example to others. I admired this in him, and also that, like me, Abshir sought explanations. Whenever we were alone together, we would have deep discussions of religion, in Somali and English, which he had taught himself to speak and read. He was nothing at all like any imam I had ever met. In Somalia, the Muslim Brotherhood was cool. Siad Barre's dictatorship was anti-clan and secular. The generation that grew up under his rule wasn't driven so much by clan. They wanted religion. They wanted Islamic law. The Brotherhood was above politics and clan. It was fighting for God's justice. And it had money. Fans were pouring in from the oil-rich Arab countries to support and promote the pure, true Islam. By the time I arrived, little congregations had formed all over Mogadishu. People called them the Assalamu Alaikums, the Blessed Bees. That was how they greeted you on the street, in Arabic, which in a Somali context was like someone suddenly spouting liturgical Latin. The most fanatical Brotherhood members, who were usually in their teens and twenties, spoke only to other Brotherhood people, and they attended their own mosques and Quran schools in houses. They sneered at the big official mosques that all the people attended, where the imams reported to the government. A Muslim Brotherhood mosque was a place of inquiry and conspiracy, where people muttered against Siad Barre and shouted doctrine at each other in corners. As Abshir took Mahat to places like that, Mahat was becoming more of a believer too. I liked Abshir's influence on my brother. As the weeks went by and we spent almost every evening all together, I found myself telling Abshir about Kenya, about myself. He liked me too and sought me out. One twilight, as we sat on the veranda at Marian Farah's house, he said to me, "I wish I could meet a girl like you." I looked up at him and answered, "And I wish I could meet a man like you." He took my hand and very poetically expressed his desire. After that, Our legs and hands seemed often to brush against each other. We happened to find each other alone. We held hands. After a few weeks, I decided to tell Mahat and Hawea that I was having some kind of relationship with Abshir. That way, Mahat could untangle matters with Abshir's older brother. It made Mahat very angry to have to write a letter to Adan to explain that I would not, in fact, be marrying Abdullahi. I told him he was wrong to have promised such a thing anyway. He yelled at me, only this time it wasn't the old Mahat twisting my arm. He lectured me on honor and the clan and the impact of my decisions on our kinsmen. Certain decisions, he informed me, were better made by the men of the family. Ichabo and the others were also scandalized by my announcement. Many kids had relationships. They kissed and touched in corners, but you weren't supposed to admit it. It was shocking, un-Islamic, un-Somali, to fall in love. You were supposed to hide such a thing. Of course, someone would have noticed and gossiped, but you were supposed to wait until the boy's family asked your father, and then you were supposed to cry. I was violating all the codes. Gossip was rampant. In Mogadishu, I felt the tension between the new wave of Brotherhood Islam and those who thought of religion as important but not all-pervading. The older generation was bothered by the mixing of the sexes but had learned to accept it as part of the modern culture of life in the city, the Magalo. In fact, some modern older women wore Western skirts too, and not all young people in Somalia were traditional. Many wanted to fall in love and date just like Westerners. But the younger generation was split into two blocks. Those who looked to the West for inspiration, and especially entertainment, and those who subscribed to the sermons of men from the Muslim Brotherhood like Boghul Saum. On my visits to Arros campus, where she was studying medicine, I saw crowds of young students strolling on the grounds. Beautiful girls, dressed in the latest Italian designs, actually held hands with their boyfriends. Arro had to pinch me and hiss in my ears not to stare. In Arro's crowd, staring was considered something that only bumpkins from the Miyi would do, and Arro had been boasting that her sisters had come to visit from abroad. Among her friends, having relatives abroad enhanced your status and proved how worldly your family was. At the university Ichabo attended, La Fole, the students seemed to be divided almost equally between the West and the Muslim Brotherhood, characterized by their choice of dress. Some girls wore Western skirts and high heels. When they passed, they left a trail of Dior, Chanel, or Anaïs, not frankincense. The boys who hung around them had fitted shirts that they tucked into their trousers and drove cars. The girls in the other group wore the jilbab, or were shrouded in the 9-yard-long cloth that my grandmother once wore as a guntino. The boys they associated with wore white robes. If they did wear trousers, they never tucked in their shirts, and the trousers, like their robes, stopped short of their ankles. They looked peculiar, with wispy beards and scrawny lower legs, but this was a way of showing how strong you are in your belief. They had as much confidence as the kids in the cool cars. When I visited Arros University, she demanded I come dressed like Iman, the famous Somali model. When I visited Ichabo, she demanded I wear the jilbab. Living in the same house with Arro and Ichabo, when they were both present, on Fridays and Saturdays, and throughout the long holiday in July and August, was like being in the middle of a religious war. Arro derided Ichabo's clothes, friends and way of life, and Ichabo made it a sacred aim of her life to persuade Arro to pray and return to the straight path of Allah. Nobody told the adults about me and Abshir, and because Mahat, Hawea, Ichabo and the rest of the family respected Abshir, they began to leave the two of us alone more often. Abshir and I talked constantly about the Prophet. Abshir thought of himself as a pure, true believer. He persuaded me to get another robe, even thicker than the zippered hijab I already wore, with material so stiff it showed not one curve of my body. I confessed to him that I found it difficult to keep up the 5 daily prayers and steer my mind from sinful thoughts. I was having more and more sinful thoughts. When we were alone, Abshir would kiss me, and he could really kiss. It was long and gentle and thrilling, and therefore sinful. Afterward, I would tell him how bad I felt in the eyes of Allah, how much that bothered me. And Abshir would say, "If we were married, then it wouldn't be sinful. We must exercise willpower and not do it anymore." So for a day or so, we would steel ourselves and refrain, and then the next day, we would look at each other and just kiss again. He would say, "I'm too weak. I think of you all day long." Our attraction was definitely mutual. But it was beginning to seem as if it were taking God for a ride. Abshir would tell me, "We must repent." So we did, and tried to steel ourselves. But then we would kiss again, sometimes even before the next evening's prayer. From Sister Aziza and from my own reading, I knew that what mattered was not just the act, but the intention. It was not only the kissing that was forbidden, or even breaking your promise to God. It was wanting to break that promise. I enjoyed those kisses, longed for them, thought about them constantly, wanted more. I fought these thoughts, but they seemed uncontrollable. I wanted Abshir, he wanted me, and that was evil. Ramadan began, the holy month of fasting, when everyone must behave in the holiest possible way. Somalia is an entirely Muslim country, and Ramadan is also a month of family togetherness, the great festive event of the year. Mahat came over to see us almost every day. When we heard the call to prayer at twilight, we would all break the day's fast together with 3 dates and a glass of water. We would pray 3 rak'ahs and then eat out of a big communal dish, laughing, happy. All the young people sitting together around our own dish, separate from the adults. At 8 p.m., when the call would come for the last prayer of the day, all of us young people walked together to the mosque. Although Abshir was an imam at his own mosque, he sometimes asked a friend to replace him in leading prayers so he could accompany us. All the shops were lit. There were people laughing in the street and huge crowds heading to the Grand Central Mosque. Inside, the large carpeted men's area was ornate. The women's area behind it was much less showy, just a white hall with sisal mats. But even so, there was an architectural sense of awe in a space so large, so charged with meaning. After the evening service, some of the older women would go home, but Ichabu and I always continued to pray, as did Mahat and his friends. Every night of that Ramadan, we prayed the whole Taraweeh, the long optional Ramadan prayer, an intensive stream of chanting and bowing that could go on until 11 o'clock. Tucked in the back, we women didn't face an imam, just a loudspeaker. But the mosque was full. There was a feeling of oneness and union. A huge sense of community from everyone involved in a small space doing just one thing and doing it voluntarily. When you pray, you're supposed to feel the force of God and know that you are in His presence. But though I tried hard to open my mind to that force, I never seemed to feel it. To be honest, I prayed because I knew I should. But I never felt very much during prayer, only the discomfort of the grass mat pressing against my feet and the unpleasant odors of some of the bodies around me as the imam droned monotonously for hours. I never felt as exalted by prayer as Ichabo said she did. Ichabo had a mystical, beatific look on her face during Taraweeh. Afterward, she would talk about how wonderful it was, how she had seen the light of Allah and felt the presence of the angels, how she had traveled in her mind to a place that resembled paradise. I never reached a transcendental state. There was no inner light. One evening, just as Ramadan was ending, we went to see Abshir preaching in his little mosque. It was just a storefront, really, in a house in Wardigle, a formerly poor neighborhood where people were beginning to build fancy houses. Abshir had a beautiful voice. He had learned the whole Quran by heart, and the way he led prayer was compelling. When he commented on the Quran, he really seemed to understand it. Abshir had a following. Although many of them were older than he was, they were still young people, all of them Muslim Brotherhood. The boys wore their sarong or kaftans short and had wispy beards. The girls, behind a partition, were silent. Standing in that women's room, I heard Abshir preaching through a loudspeaker. He preached that intimacy before marriage is forbidden. He talked about purity, purity in deed and thought, and said the remedy for forbidden thoughts is more prayer. Afterward, he tried to kiss me. It was Ramadan, which made it triply worse. I was repelled. My reaction was completely physical. My skin crawled. I found I couldn't bear him to touch me anymore. There was something creepy about it. I detached myself from Abshir. He saw how shocked I was and asked him to take us home. In hindsight, I don't think of Abshir as a creep at all. He was just as trapped in a mental cage as I was. Abshir and I, and all the other young people who joined the Muslim Brotherhood movement, wanted to live as much as possible like our beloved Prophet. But the rules of the last Messenger of Allah were too strict, and their very strictness led us to hypocrisy. At the time, though, I could see only that either Abshir or Islam was thoroughly flawed, and of course, I assumed it was Abshir. I told Mahat I wanted to end things with Abshir. My brother was exasperated with me. He thought I was typically female, incapable of knowing my own mind. I wrote Abshir a letter. He pleaded and begged. It was as if he had lost his mind. He took to hanging out at Marian Farsa's, lamenting to Ichabo. The whole family, the whole Osman Mahmud clan, began looking after him. Most of the family, including the women, explained my sudden change of heart as the result of female indecision. They said women were in the grip of invisible forces that played with their minds and made them switch from one extreme mood to another. That was why Allah had ordained that the testimony of two women is equal to that of one man, and also why women should not be allowed to govern or accept public offices, for leadership requires mindful contemplation and judgments reached after careful thought. Women lacked all these by nature. We were flighty and irrational, and it was much better for us if our fathers and other male guardians decided who we should spend the rest of our lives with. Only Hawaya understood me. She liked Abshir, but she hadn't liked seeing the way I was with him, didn't like the robe he had me wearing, and my recent brotherhood behavior. Somehow, in that period, she managed to lay her hands on some books and pass them to me. Even the bad ones came as a cool stream to a dry riverbed. They provided me with an escape. I was loath to admit it to her, but I was disappointed with Somalia. I had expected a country where everything made sense to me, a country where I would belong, where I could be accepted, where I could root and discover myself as a person. But even though I loved the heat, the wind, the smells, I didn't fit in. There was a sense of belonging in Somalia. I could take for granted who I was, and enjoyed the easy acceptance of my family and clan. But even though Hawaya had warned me, I was not prepared for the limitations and the price I had to pay for that sense of belonging. Everyone was involved in everyone else's business. The complete lack of privacy, of individual space, and the social control were suffocating. Conforming to my allotted role in Somali society, in a clan, in a sub-clan, in Islam, might have brought me peace of mind, a fixed destiny, and a secure place in heaven. I had less trouble with obedience than Hawaya did. But still, I wanted more than to marry Abshir and bear his children, a destiny just like my mother's. I wanted a challenge, something daring. I felt, suddenly, that the price of my sense of belonging in Somalia would be my sense of self. Religion gave me a sense of peace only from its assurance of a life after death. It was fairly easy to follow most of the rules: good behavior, politeness, avoiding gossip and pork and usury and alcohol. But I had found that I couldn't follow the deeper rules of Islam that controlled sexuality and the mind. I didn't want to follow them. I wanted to be someone to stand on my own. If I stayed in Somalia and married Abshir, I would become a faceless unit. That prospect seized me with a sudden panic. I was in a state of moral confusion, a crisis of faith. I spoke to Mahat about my doubts and fears, and he comforted me. He said it was all normal, just part of growing up, that the questions, the feelings of confusion, and the sense of moral crisis were part of the transition into adulthood. He said, just remain sincere, and you'll see everything will be fine. I took to going to the mosque more often in that period as I searched for answers. I began to attend the Friday noon prayers at the central mosque, to listen to the imam's sermons in Somali. Again, though, I found myself having mental debates with him. You are not supposed to argue with an imam. You are definitely not supposed to argue with the word of Allah. Islam is submission. You submit on earth in order to earn your place in heaven. Life on earth is a test, and I was failing it, even though I was trying as hard as I knew how to. I was failing as a Muslim. When I prayed, I felt that the angel on my left shoulder was growing weary of writing down all my sins. I imagined arriving in the hereafter with a slim book of good deeds and a volume of sins as vast as the unabridged Oxford Dictionary. I wanted to feel a renewed sense of being a Muslim, a sense of the meaning of Allah, but I felt nothing. I told myself it meant that Allah didn't want me. I wasn't worthy. Hawa moved out of Marian's house. She couldn't stand Ichabo's disapproval and Arro's constant sniping, and moved in with Ibada Dadi Magan, our cousin. As the director of Digfer Hospital, Ibada had contacts with the United Nations and got Hawa a job. Then she found me a job too, with a small office that the United Nations Development Programme had set up to establish phone lines into rural Somalia. The work was not inspiring. I was supposed to be a secretary, but I often ended up translating for my boss, a rather bewildered Englishman. He would meet with a delegation from the provinces, and I would try to explain why he wouldn't just give them the cash to set up a phone line. He would also try to explain why they shouldn't tear up and resell the cables he had just laid while they ignored him and talked among themselves. He had no authority over his staff. But this was a so-called multilateral project, so he was under orders to respect their views and their way of doing things, even if they had neither views nor methodology. While I was working in that office, I began to realize just how much fighting was going on in the country. More and more United Nations offices were closing and leaving the rural areas because they were unsafe. The Hawiya clan had formed their own political movement, called the United Somali Congress, led by Ali Mahdi and General Muhammad Farah Aidid. Although Mogadishu itself was peaceful, with Siad Barre still in control, the Hawiya were now in rebellion against the dictator in the south, and the Darod and the Isaaq in the north. Working also gave me a close-up look at the Somali bureaucracy. Almost every civil servant I encountered seemed abysmally ignorant. Their scorn for all things Galo, including my boss, was profound. Galo usually means white unbeliever, but not always. Ma used this word for the Kenyans too. They were completely uninterested in doing their jobs and spent their time scheming about how to transfer government funds, a euphemism for stealing them. In Somalia, to have a stake in government was to have a family member in the place where tax money and money from kickbacks was distributed. No more, no less. I saw what that does to a nation. It destroys public trust. In the face of such widespread corruption, no wonder people were susceptible to the lure of preachers who said all the answers were to be found in the holy writings. Organizations set up by the Brotherhood sympathizers were not corrupt. Many Somalis had ceased to trust the banking system and carried out financial transactions in shops and warehouses that were owned by Brotherhood people. The Brotherhood also gave free health care to the needy. They set up Quran schools for the unemployed youths who roamed the city. On Fridays, they distributed grain and meat outside the mosque. Their ranks were swelling, as was their influence. A United Nations car took me to and from work, and I wore a headscarf in the office, where I worked from 8 until 2. It was a comfortable routine, but my job was tedious. My boss was polite, but we had no personal interaction, no conversation or teaching. When work ended, I went back to Marian's house and talked to the maid. Marian's house was filling up with more and more of her Marihan relatives from the countryside. They came in dribs and drabs to escape the troubles in the provinces. Ichabo and Marian tried to enforce house rules and teach these country cousins to flush the toilet and sit on chairs. But if Ichabo or Arro spoke to them sharply, the visitors responded angrily and accused the girls of having turned away from our culture. There were reports that crime was rising in the neighborhood. One of Marian's recently arrived uncles bought a gun. Hawea and I received constant invitations from people on my father's side of the family. We went to my cousin Aflau's house and spent time with his wife, Shukri, his sisters Amran and Idil, and his brother Ainasha, who lived with them all and worked at Aflau's espresso bar downtown. They were a clamorous, friendly family, full of gossip about Marian's side of the family. Ainasha in particular hated anyone from Siad Barfe's clan, the Marehan, and he had a grudge against Marian. Aflau's sister Amran took us strolling along the beach, where the Arabs lived in houses enclosed by high walls the color of the sand. Once in a while, a woman completely covered in black would scuttle along the walls heading in. These women walked barefoot because of the sand, and all you could see of them was their feet. Even though these shapeless black heaps were moving forward, they might just as well have been inanimate. You couldn't talk to them. Amran called them the confined. She said, "Pay no attention to them," with disdain. It reminded me of Saudi Arabia. Soon after I broke it off with Abshir, I stopped wearing the stiff, horribly hot cloak that the Brotherhood girls wore and reverted to my black robe from Nairobi. It was cooler. But on top of a long dress and long sleeves, even that robe came to seem excessive. It stood out a lot on the street. Nobody in Somalia wears black. I began dressing in a light-colored dera, like most people. A long tunic with a flap on the side and a cotton shawl draped on my head. Far fewer women dressed in Western clothes in Mogadishu in 1990 than they had just 10 or 20 years before. They had always been a minority, but now the tide had visibly shifted against them. Ainanshe used to say, "Before the Brotherhood came, you could see everyone's arms and legs. We never used to notice. But now that women are covering so much, all I can think about is those round calves and silky arms and the hair smelling of coconut. I never used to think about a neck before, but ooh, a neck is so sexy now." Ichabo's schoolmates and Ainanshe's pals from downtown would laugh at the Brotherhood's gibberish and sneer that it was all Arab cultural dominance. But a few weeks later, some of them too would be wearing robes and spouting Arabic. The movement wasn't only about religion. Its members were hardworking and clever, They probably received money from Saudi Arabia. But there were also lots of successful businesses run by Brotherhood followers, especially in transportation and money transfers. They helped swell the Brotherhood's coffers. One afternoon, Aynansha was walking us back to Aunt Marian's neighborhood after lunch, as he always did. Because he hated Marian and all the Marihan, he used to leave us about 100 yards from her house. Just before we reached the corner where we usually bade him goodbye, a hand gripped my neck, hard, and I felt the sharp blade of a knife pressed against my throat. I looked at Hawea. A scrawny man with huge, red-rimmed dark eyes was pointing a knife at her, too. I assumed this was the end. I remember thinking, well, we made it to age 18 and 20. I knew Aynansha was armed. He always had a little pistol on him, but under these circumstances, that wasn't going to be much use. The gold, said the man who gripped Hawea. I croaked, we are not wearing any. The man holding me started feeling my ears and neck under my shawl, keeping the sharp knife pointed into my throat. He sneered. Where do these tall, beautiful girls come from, and who's this little shit they're standing on the street with? The man was Isaac, I could tell from his accent. Mogadishu was filled with Isaac refugees, displaced from the north by the fighting. I thought perhaps he could let us go if we were Isaac too, so I quickly began reciting my grandmother's clan, just as she taught me. Aynansha caught on. He was very calm. He didn't pull his gun out. If he had, my throat would have been slit in a minute. See? These girls are your Isaac sisters, he told the muggers. And I am married to another of their sisters. I am escorting them home. Just as quickly as they appeared, the men melted away. After that, Hawea and I realized that it wasn't safe to walk on the streets of Mogadishu alone anymore. Every day there were reports of killings, rapes, and houses burned by armed robbers. Homeless refugees lived all over the place. Displaced people like the Isaac men who attacked us had moved to the city with nothing to lose, armed and filled with rage. Army soldiers also roamed about with their weapons. Although we didn't yet know this, large sections of the army had defected and were joining the various clan-led factions all over Somalia who could not wait to get their teeth into Siad Barre's throat. In contrast to the clan warfare, the Brotherhood seemed to have a more universal character because it included people of every clan. Of these groups, the Brotherhood seemed to many to be the most reliable. As its following grew, the movement became more self-assured. Brotherhood imams began operating in larger mosques, no longer restricting themselves to semi-clandestine houses. We heard more and more gossip about openly political sermons announcing that the government's days were over and the time for Islamic law had come. Siad Barre began sending troops to mosques to disperse large gatherings. They would shoot their machine guns overhead as a signal of who was in power, and people were often killed in the ensuing stampedes. After every such action, the Brotherhood's support in the city would grow. The movement had become a power to reckon with in businesses, hospitals, schools, and universities. Ichabu's University, La Fole, on the outskirts of Mogadishu, was pretty much a Brotherhood enclave now. In mid-1990, a group of politicians, elders representing virtually every clan, published a manifesto calling for Siad Barre to resign. They told him that the country was in chaos and he should relinquish power so elections could be held. Siad Barre had some of these men thrown in jail. A stable peace in the country seemed remote. Marian's country relatives bought several small machine guns and began sitting at her gate day and night with coils of ammunition across their bellies. The same happened at other relatives' homes. Guards, armed to the teeth, often clan members from the countryside, took up positions in front of the doors of their urban relatives to protect their lives and property. I fell out with Arro and moved into Ibado Dada's house. One particularly lugubrious Saturday, I decided to visit my Aunt Khadija, my mother's much older half-sister. Khadija was grand and imperious, almost as old as my grandmother, but taller, more regal, and even sharper-tongued. I groaned inwardly as I thought about the tongue-lashing she was bound to inflict on me for having visited her so little in the months I had been in Mogadishu. I was careful to be impeccably clean and ironed my clothes, and I made sure I had a present for her. Khadija was a hawk about etiquette. She pounced on every infelicity of diction. You had to wait for her to greet you and then greet her poetically back, standing perfectly upright. I acquitted myself acceptably at the doorway. We swept into the dining room for tea. I marveled at the room and its antique European chairs and knives and forks. Khadija must have been the only woman in Mogadishu to live this way. I was so astonished that despite my wary pledge to myself to put on my best manners, I made the mistake